Thanks, Gifre, for inviting me and giving me this opportunity to give this talk. I put this kind of symbol, which has some, looks like some geometric object, which also looks like a symbol of a company or something like that, but it's not that. It's basically a tensor, which describes some kind of topological order in higher dimensions. In this talk, we won't get into that point. But yeah, if you're interested, please tell me, and then we can talk after the talk about that. So this talk is about tensors for topological quantum matter, which sounds very general from the title. But what I will talk about is somehow try to understand topological order in tensor network states in 2+1 dimensions, at least especially for this talk. Just to manage our expectations about the talk, it's about special type of states with certain type of entanglement structure. And more specifically, it's about ground state spaces of many body lattice models, which are long-range entangled and topology dependent. So I know that these three things, I don't need to explain it here, but I still will take some time to explain what is a many body lattice model, what do I mean by long-range entanglement, and what do I mean by topology dependent ground state space. So here's the outline. We basically have two motivations to study topological orders. And the first comes from quantum computation. And the roots of this motivation lies in quantum error correcting codes, which is realized mainly by Kitaev. But actually, in general, there's somehow a broader motivation to look at topological order or any kind of order in quantum matter or in matter. And it basically comes from the heart of physics. People, and we somehow want to understand how order emerges from the elementary parts. So I will take some time to explain these motivations and why we study topological order. And then I move on to tensor network states. And I will take some time to explain the basics of tensor networks. I will try to present it as a natural tool to study condensed matter systems. And given the importance of topological order and the naturalness of tensor networks to study condensed matter systems, I will introduce the new framework that we introduced to explain topological order in tensor networks in two space dimensions. Then I'll continue with fixed point examples, which are twisted quantum doubles and string nets. And then I will continue by showing that the same framework that we introduced here can also be used to understand SPT phases in tensor networks. And I will end up the discussion with a recent work where we studied anions. How do we understand anions in terms of tensor networks, which we introduced in this framework? So Kitaev had said this idea that somehow that there's this problem of encoding logical qubits such that it's robust against local noise. And the simple, the groundbreaking idea of Kitaev was that if we encode the logical qubits non-locally to the physical system, then it's intuitively robust against local noise. And he made this idea precise by writing out concrete models where he defines the code space, the logical qubits, as the ground states of the system. And if you want to do any non-trivial operation on this code space, you have to act non-locally on your physical system, which is extremely hard for a local noise to mimic. If a local noise wants to mimic a non-trivial operation in the code space, it really has to mimic this non-local operator, which is whose probability for a local noise is exponentially small, is exponentially decreasing with the system size. And he gave the famous example, which we call toric code, and it encodes 2 qubits on torus, and it should be like 2 g qubits on g genus surfaces. And the non-trivial operations on the code space are Wilson loop operators. So they map, they're trivial Wilson loop operators, which acts trivially on the state, but they're also non-trivial Wilson loop operators, which maps one state in the code space to another state in the code space. And these are the topologically non-trivial cycles. These are along the topologically non-trivial cycles. So as I said, the broader interest comes from the physics itself. So physicists try to understand all the fundamental laws, all the elementary particles, and so on, and how they interact with fundamental laws. And they were extremely successful in the last century. They understood that there are electrons, protons, and there are also other constituents like quarks and so on, and they know how they interact with fundamental forces. But of course, just because you know the fundamental forces, just because you know the fundamental laws, doesn't mean that you can explain all diversity that you see in the nature. And the explanation for the diversity, like how the diversity that we see in nature comes from the elementary parts and from the elementary laws, it's been explained by how your material, how your elementary constituents are ordered in different ways. So the idea is that different kind of orders leads to the diversity that we see in the nature. And this intuitive idea actually is at the heart of what physicists call phase of matter or phase of quantum matter. So phase here means that it's really different kind of things that you can measure from the system. And the claim is that different kind of orders leads to different kind of phases that you observe in the nature. So let's look at some examples. In this talk, I will restrict only to zero temperature case. If we look at classical systems, there's only one phase at zero temperature, which I will call the trivial phase, denoted by product state, because you don't allow thermal fluctuations, and because it's a classical system, you also don't allow any superposition. So the only possible state that you can have is a product state, which kind of means that everything is frozen at zero temperature. So you have trivial phase for classical systems at zero temperature. But then Landoi came up with a formalism, which is called spontaneous symmetry breaking. And with that, you can explain quantum systems as long as they have local order parameters. So as long as your system have a local order parameter, then you can classify its symmetry breaking pattern, and you can understand the phase of that quantum system. So for a long time, physicists thought that this is the whole story, but in 1980s, people found that quantum systems that look locally the same, but they still have some properties which are different. Two quantum systems, if you look at them locally, they are the same, but they're not the same because they have some edge currents and so on, which are different from them, which are different from each other, and these are different quantum systems. These are systems with different quantum orders. And people thought about what can be the order parameter of these, because there's no local order parameter, because there's no way to distinguish these systems locally. They came up with the idea of a non-local order parameter. And for these systems, this local indistinguishability is a key feature, because this is the reason that you are trying to explain the systems with non-local order parameters. So somehow these systems have to be locally indistinguishable, but there has to be some non-local order parameters. There has to be some non-local properties of these systems. And that's why people are looking at topology-dependent properties, such as the ground state space being topology-dependent, and so on. Okay, so let's, after this motivation, let's remember again what this talk is about. It's about special states with certain type of entanglement structure, and specifically it's about ground state spaces of many-body lattice models which are long-range entangled and topology dependent. Here comes the famous example. So what I mean by a many-body lattice model, first you have a lattice, and here you have square lattice, and you can put degrees of freedom everywhere on the lattice. Like you can put it on vertices, on edges, on plaquettes, and so on. For this model, we will just put degrees of freedom on the edges. So there are spin half degrees of freedom at these dots on the edges. So let's say they can get value 0 or value 1. And we are free to take any superposition of any configuration because it's a quantum system. And then he defines this Hamiltonian, which consists of two kind of terms. One of them is a vertex term. The other one is a plaquette term. The vertex term make these four spins interact by this XXXX term. The plaquette term makes these terms interact with each other, which are next to the plaquette P with this Z term. And that's the Hamiltonian. So if you look at it carefully, you will see that this is a commuting projector Hamiltonian, and all these terms can only get plus or minus one values. So the eigenvalues of vertex and plaquette operators are all plus and minus one. So we can find the ground state. Yes. So the crucial thing about this vertex term is that it makes sure that only a closed loop of ones appear in the ground state. Well, maybe if you write it in the dual picture, yes. And the plaquette term makes sure that this closed loop of ones comes with equal weight superposition in the state, in the ground state. So at the end, we know that the ground states are equal weight superposition of closed number of loops of ones, but it somehow may depend on the topology that you put your system in. So let's put our system on the torus. What we will see is that we have four ground states. The first ground state is equal weight superposition of even number of closed loops along the L1 direction, and even number of closed loops along the L2 direction. And the second ground state is equal weight superposition of even number of L1 loops and odd number of L2 loops, and so on. So what we see here is that we have four ground states, which we cannot distinguish locally, because if we look at these states locally, and by looking at the states locally, I mean doing local measurements on the states, there's no way to understand the parity of these closed loops, because it's a global property. If I look at it here, maybe I see only odd number of ones going through my region, but there's probably another loop going on here, and then I think that I'm in this ground state, but I'm actually in this ground state. So it's totally a global property, which is impossible to measure locally. So from this example, it should be clear what a many-body lattice model is, and What do I mean by topology-dependent ground state space? This, of course, is just an example, but it's really a clear example that clarifies these two things. But I still didn't say anything about what do I mean by long-range entanglement. So again, let's look at toric code and let's try to feel what can it be intuitively. So imagine that we are looking at reduced density matrix rho A of a closed region. And we know that the ground state is an equal weight superposition of closed number of one loops. This means that along the boundary, this reduced density matrix can only have even number of ones. So if I look at the spins which are passing through the boundary, I can only find even number of ones if I'm guaranteed that I'm in the ground state. So if you imagine that you are given a reduced density matrix, and somebody asked you whether you are in the ground state or not, the first thing that you have to check is that whether the number of ones passing through the boundary is even or odd. If it's odd, there's no way that you are in the ground state, because you basically have some excitation. So, but of course, you cannot do this measurement locally. Like if you only look at, you know, if you only make a measurement locally here, then you might see that you have odd number of ones passing through the boundary. But this is not the case. You have to look. So you can conclude that by observing partially this region, you can conclude that you are in the excited state. But this is not correct, because you have to observe the whole boundary, and there's no way of doing this locally. So we somehow see that this is really a non-local property of the state, that the fact that there are even number of ones passing through the boundary. And in terms of entropy, if we try to think about what this means in terms of entropy, it means that you are basically cutting your Hilbert space by half when you restrict your boundary states to consist of only even number of ones. And this practically means that you cut out your Hilbert space, all your probabilities by one half, meaning that you get log 2 one half correction to the entropy. And this is what Peskel, Kitaev, and Levin and Wen defined as topological entanglement entropy. They defined it in another way, but this is basically the root of the topological entanglement entropy. Yes, so I didn't define what long-range entanglement is, but I tried to give you a feeling about it. It's a non-local property of the state that you cannot detect by looking at it locally. Okay. So now let's switch the topic to tensor networks, and let's step by step write down a tensor network state. So we again start with a lattice, and we assign bipartite maximal entangled states between each nearest neighbor site. So this is a site, this is another site, which is a neighbor of this site, and I assign these maximal entangled states. So here there's one part of the entangled state, here there's the other part. This is the state which is in this form, up to normalization. And big D, here we will call bond dimension. It's the dimension of this Hilbert space where these maximally entangled states are living on. And for reasons that will become obvious in the next slides, we will call these spaces where these entangled states live on, we will call them virtual space. So now, what do you see here is a product state, which I show with psi prime, and it's omega tensor n, assuming that there are like n sites here. Here we have omega tensor and product state. And the important thing to realize is that there's an operator H prime, which is in this simple form, such that psi prime is the zero eigenvalue state of this operator. And this is a positive operator. So if we interpret this H prime as Hamiltonian, psi prime is the ground state of this H prime, right? Because it projects out at every two sides, it projects out these entangled states. So this psi prime is the ground state of this H prime. Okay, I think until now it's a bit boring. So we try to make things interesting by inserting linear maps at every vertex and try to understand the state that comes out of it. So at every vertex, we introduce a linear map, which we denote by A. It's a map from this virtual space to physical space. So it's a map from these black lines to this red dot. And red dot we call as physical space, because at the end, all these black lines, all this virtual space will be contracted, and you will end up with a physical space. So you will end up what you call the physical state. And this, a little bit misleadingly, I'm showing by A tensor N, omega tensor N, but A doesn't act on omega such that it's a product state. It's really not a product state. A acts in the way that you see in this picture. So A really couples some of these omegas locally, right? And then, so we knew that this H prime, so this omega tensor N is the ground state of this H prime, but then with this simple construction, we can write another Hamiltonian, this H, such that psi is the ground state of this H, simply because omega tensor N is the ground state of this H prime. Because these AA minus one, they cancel each other and so on. So if H prime, if this is the ground state of this, and psi is the ground state of H. So this is what people call a tensor network state, and in general, in particular, PEPs. And this is what people call parent Hamiltonian of the PEPs, psi. Yes. So yeah. So one thing that I put everywhere the same tensors, the same linear map A. But of course, you can choose to put different A's at every point. This only makes your state non-translation invariant. But if you want translation invariant PEPs, you can just put everywhere the same local tensor A.
Is it unusual H? Is it still local? Is H local?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So are you assuming that A can be inverted?
That's right. Here I skip many details.
Okay. You're assuming that A.
Yes, can that's correct. Yes, certainly. Yes. So now to make the notation easier, I just erased all these dots representing the tensors, tensor A. So you should assume that when black lines intersect, an A is sitting on there. So these are the virtual spaces, and then at every intersection there's a map which maps these virtual degrees of freedom to physical degree of freedom. And this is your state, psi. So it's better you get used to this notation, because I won't use any more of these. I will only draw some pictures which denotes the state and which only shows the local tensor A from now on. So yeah, if we summarize what we saw about tensor networks, first of all, I think first important thing is that there are virtual spaces and there are physical spaces. And you can only, physical observables can only act on physical subspaces, physical spaces, physical Hilbert spaces. They cannot act on virtual spaces directly. But they can have some access into that that we will see in future. And okay, so the is there a question? So somehow the idea and the way that we are proceeding here is a little bit reverse if we compare it how we learned in university, right? Because we are first given Hamiltonian and then we try to find eigenstates. We try to find ground states, excitations, and so on. But here it's just the reverse. Here we start with some product state and we introduce these local tensors. And somehow the structure of the whole state is encoded in this local tensor A. And we first start from local tensor, we find the state, and given the state, and given this construction, we automatically have a local Hamiltonian. So it's not the other way around. It's not from Hamiltonian to the state, but it's from tensor to the state and from state to the Hamiltonian. So this is very much like these ansatz states that's been done in condensometry in the 1980s. So you have some Hamiltonian that you actually cannot solve, but there are some clever people who can actually give some ansatz states, some example states, which are actually ground states of the Hamiltonian of interest. So this is more like a systematized way of giving an ansatz state to some physical Hamiltonians. Yeah, there are also numerous other properties of these tensor network states, such that if you look at the entropy, it's bounded by the area of the region, and there are also relations to efficient simulation of quantum systems and so on. But at least for this talk, we are only dealing with what a tensor network state and how to construct it. So we saw that topological order is interesting and we want to understand it. And we understand it, we want to understand it from tensor network point of view, and here are the goals. So we want to define the properties, the key properties of the local tensor, such that we can find topological order in the tensor network state, which is defined by this local tensor. And one motivation to do everything in terms of tensor networks is to study non-RG fixed point topologically ordered models. So if you look at the literature, if you look at the Levin-Mann models or Dycroft-Witten and all these kind of models, they're all fixed point models. And it's really hard to study how you deform it from the fixed points and where this phase transition occurs and so on. But in the tensor network language, if we can manage the first goal, then it will give some great hints about how to study non-RG fixed point models and how to study phase transitions. So that's kind of another motivation to study topological order in terms of tensor networks. And of course, the biggest goal is to find new models, which may be possible in 2 plus 1D and is highly probable in higher dimensions. Okay, so the new concepts that we introduced are something that we call MPO injectivity. So this is nothing but expressing local virtual subspaces where this local tensor is supported on in terms of matrix product operators. We will come to that point. And the other concept that we introduced is what we call pulling through. And you will see that this is kind of a symmetry of the local tensor, but it's not the symmetry. It's not like a global symmetry on your system, but it's like a local gauge symmetry. But it's about the virtual levels. So you don't act on the physical levels of the local tensor, but you will see that there are some symmetries of the tensor which purely acts on the virtual level. Okay. So first, we want to understand what's the most general definition of, so how can we define where this local tensor is supported on? So we know that this local tensor A is a map from virtual degrees of freedom, which are these three lines, to physical degree of freedom, which is this line. And we want to understand on what subspace of these virtual Hilbert space this tensor A is supported on. And this, we say that there exists a pseudo-inverse, A plus, such that this contraction over physical legs gives us the subspace where this local tensor is supported on. And the assumption that we make is that it should be expressible in terms of matrix product operators. So to clarify the notation, each M is an MPO, is a matrix product operator, which is basically a four-leg tensor. So it has these legs, two red legs and two black legs. And at the intersection of the black and red line, there's a four-leg tensor sitting. And this is a tensor, this is an operator contraction where we contract over the red leg. And we say that this local tensor A is supported on the subspace, which is defined by this projector, and which is expressible in terms of MPOs, these MPOs. Yes? It means that if you input a state, so this A is a map from virtual degrees of freedom, these three virtual degrees of freedom to this physical degree of freedom, right? Imagine that you input a state on these boundaries, and I say that if A is not supported, if this boundary state is not supported in the subspace where A is supported in, then this tensor will give you zero. Mm-hmm. Is that clear for everybody? Because that's kind of crucial.
So does this mean this MPO defines the projector?
This doesn't mean, but there are other conditions.
No, but what I mean is, do I have to think of this red circle to this?
Yes, you should think.
If I square it, I get it back.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's one condition that you can derive from other conditions, or you can just assume that. Yes.
And A plus is not inverted.
No, it doesn't have to be.
You're inverting.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Right. For fixed point models, it's just a decker. Yeah. So this somehow means that the virtual degrees of freedom, the accessible virtual degrees of freedom, are described by these projectors, and they're determined by these closed loop of MPOs. Because the states which is not within the subspace, they were not already there, like they were not there from the beginning, because your state is not supported on this virtual subspace. Okay, so the other property that we need is probably more intuitive. It's what we called pulling through, or symmetry on the virtual level. So the idea and the intuition behind this condition is that if you just think about physically, if you think about Kitaev's model or string net models, there are Wilson loop operators that map different ground states to each other, but their exact position doesn't matter. You can deform these Wilson operators, these line operators, freely on the lattice wherever you want. So now our aim is that, because here we already mapped the physical space to virtual space. So somehow whatever we have on the physical space, we should have it on the virtual space, right? And then, at the same time, we should also have analogs of these Wilson lines on the virtual level. And this is what we introduce as a condition, is that these matrix product operators, and they sit on this intersection on the red and black lines, it should be deformable along the lattice. And the simplest way to ensure this property is that it's deformable through one local tensor. So this is the local tensor. This is the NPO, except endpoints. I can deform it through the local tensor to the other side of the tensor. Here I have NPO tensor. Here I have tensor, NPO, NPO. So this should intuitively remind you these deformable Wilson lines, please.
Just to be clear, that red line at the bottom is not going behind the black line, that's another second tensor?
No, yeah, so, yeah, I think that there's, so they're not going behind. If they intersect, they always intersect. There's no braiding or something like that, no. Here there sits an NPO, here there sits an NPO, here there sits an NPO. Yes, but from right to left, it decreases.
Mm-hmm. So the physical index is not playing a role. Is that because we're considering one tensor corresponding to the vacuum, to the ground state?
Yes, mm-hmm. So that's correct, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. If there is an excitation, you are not able to do that. And this is one way of detecting excitations. Yeah. Okay, so from these two conditions that I showed you, you can prove that the ground states, the ground state space is spanned by these Q tensors. So this Q tensor is sitting at the intersection of two MPOs. So if you think that you are on the torus, this MPO starts here, it goes, wraps around the torus, and it comes back, and it sticks to the other side of this Q, and this MPO, it starts here and it wraps around the torus, comes back and it sticks at the upper part of this Q. And this Q is just a tensor which somehow entangles all these MPOs in some way.
Sorry, in this picture, did we just invert all the A's?
Yes, here all these A's are inverted. Okay. Here you have all these subspaces.
So we can think of this as the representation of the ground. Of a ground state after inverting all the invertible A's.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right. So the place of Q is relevant, is irrelevant because we know that these ground states should be locally indistinguishable. So you can pull this MPO through the lattice everywhere, you are also able to pull this Q on the lattice everywhere you want.
Sorry, is it obvious that you can pull the MPO through the lattice? How would you pull the MPO through the sides?
Mm-hmm.
How would you do it?
I do it with this condition. But you mean whenever there's no physical lag?
No, I'm just saying two red lines.
Uh-huh.
Is there any rule about what happens when you have two red lines? If you go forward,
mm-hmm.
if you want to, you just said it, you're mm-hmm. going to pull the lines.
Yes.
Some of the red lines across sides.
Yes.
What are the rules to pull a red line across the side?
You mean this red line?
Yes.
To here.
Yes. How are you going to do that? Is it because red lines commute? I see two red lines
now. No, two red lines doesn't commute, but one thing that you can do is that you can just apply the local tensor here.
You can do what? Sorry?
You can apply the local tensor here. Okay. And then this loop annihilates because the local tensor is invariant under this loop. Because local tensor leaves within the subspace defined by this projector. And then you just pull this red line through, and then you can again invert A back.
Isn't that the same as saying that the red line can go across a red line?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. If there is a loop of.
Yes. If there is a loop of red line can go over this loop of red line. There are different ways to do it. You can also do it directly. Yeah.
Why did you want to invert the A through? Like, why did you want to go this way? Is this now a nicer way to?
No, I think that was just easy for me to copy from the paper in terms of pictures. Yeah. I should also put these A's with these physical legs here as well. Somehow the idea is that the physical or virtual doesn't matter. They all kind of equivalent if you know the subspace where, if you know the virtual space where they live in. Yes. To find the different ground states, you should still check the linearly independent states on the physical level that's been derived from different Q tensors. So it's still not guaranteed, like only because you can pull everything through and you have this impure injectivity doesn't guarantee you that you have interesting topological order. You can also end up with a product state. You can also end up with a GZ state. And these cases are also covered in this formalism. Yes. But there are some tests to do it, like by measuring the entropy using these matrix product operators and so on, and looking at topological entanglement entropy to understand whether it's really topologically ordered or not.
How do I have to understand the extra two lines that you added here? I mean, before you talked about ground states of
yes.
Mm-hmm. Now you added two extra lines. How do I
yes.
have to think about
this? So I actually, yeah. I didn't add them. So if I try to, so first I inverted all these local tensors, and I get this picture. Now, of course, I can have any boundary tensor I want, because I'm still in the ground state. So we can have any boundary tensor of this region.
Of fixed-point Hamiltonian, right? When you invert the operators, you change the Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But I'm happy to consider that Hamiltonian as a scalar Hamiltonian.
Yes.
So this could be a scalar Hamiltonian.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now you have the ground state of some Hamiltonian.
Yes, but we are on the ground state only within this region. We don't know anything about the boundary. So there can be Hamiltonian here. But there can also be the Hamiltonian, which somehow also consists of these degrees of freedom in connection with these degrees of freedom.
When you say that this is locally the ground state, is this because we're assuming something about the rest of the tensor network? For instance, that the reduced density matrix will not depend on what we put, the local reduced density matrix will not depend on how we compute the tensor network?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And how is that justified? This is a local piece of the tensor network.
Yes.
But you're saying that the reduced density matrix only depends on this local piece.
Right.
And why is that?
Because that's how we, so we somehow begin with.
If we trace out the rest of the system, is it a W-square?
Oh yeah, I think that's a. I think there's a critical point. Like there's a point that I have to make. I think what we say is that the reduced density matrix is supported on this subspace.
Okay.
We don't say that this is the reduced density matrix.
Okay.
That's right. Uh-huh. That's yeah. So now we want to. So this is one way of closing the tensor network. And here we assign a boundary tensor, right? And these legs are all connected to these boundary tensors. these legs. But if we want to close this tensor network on the torus, there are other ways of closing it. Like there's one, the other way to close it is the following. There's another boundary tensor, B prime. And we want these two boundary tensors to be such that they are the same state, because we are describing the same state. And we want to find the boundary tensors which is in the span of these states and these states. It's the same network, but with different boundary tensors. So I put, so here that this is 1, 2, 3, 4. Here is 1, 2, 3, 4. So I just shifted this one. No, this is, it's like this. Yes. Mm-hmm. Because we are doing it on a torus, so we might as well first inverting these and then putting a boundary tensor, closing the tensor. We might choose to close the tensor network in this way as well. And it should be equivalent. And when you find, there are also two other ways. There are like two, that's the first way, that's the second way. There's a third and fourth way as well. And you know that you describe the same subspace. And if you take the intersection of these tensor networks, you find that these boundary tensors should be of this type, of this Q tensor.
I'll ask you later.
Okay.
Just to be sure, the boundary tensors for these different choices of fundamental domain of the torus,
mm-hmm.
they won't be identical. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually a key point. Like at the beginning, we were just saying that intuitively there has to be MPO loops which maps different ground states to each other, and they only meet, like they meet at some point, right? There are two non-trivial cycles of the torus, and they meet at some point, and okay, let's just put a tensor there. You can look at that, you can look at this Q tensor in this way, which is like purely intuitive and not justified. But if you actually really try to derive the subspace, the ground state subspace in the torus, you think of different type of closures with these boundary tensors, then the only possibility is this Q tensor. You end up with that type of tensor. So how many minutes do I have?
10 minutes.
Oh. Okay. Okay. So yeah. So let's look at the examples. And the first examples are twisted quantum doubles. And let's see what twisting means. So I think it has better definitions, but that's I think the best intuitive way to do it in 1 minute. Assume that you take the Torricot ground state, which is equal weight superposition of loops. And then you say that you take the same state, but you put a a minus sign if the number of these loops are odd. So you change your state, you just count the number of loops in the configuration, and you put a minus sign if you count them to be odd. So this looks like from here to here, it's easy to explain. It's extremely easy to say in words, but of course, what I'm doing here is a global operation, right? Because I'm counting all these loops. They may be very large, they may be very small, and to do this, you have to do a global transformation. So from here to here is not physical. From here to here, there is a phase transition. From here to here, you have to take your time polynomially, scaling polynomially with the system size. So these are in different phases. And double semion is sometimes also called twisted toric coat. It's like giving this sign, some kind of giving this twist to the toric coat. And in general, they're expressed in terms of, in 2 plus 1 dimension, they're expressed in terms of 3 cocycles. And this is a function from 3 group elements to a phase. And this is the tensor network for twisted quantum doubles, where these alpha, beta, and gamma, these lines, they are the virtual lines. And these ijk are the physical lines. And this local tensor is a map from these virtual lines to physical lines with this weight expressed in terms of 3 cocycle omega. And these are the matrix product operators. So it maps this physical leg to this physical leg. These are the virtual legs, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And this MPO is labeled by group element G. So this is kind of a middle leg. So this MPO maps virtual legs, alpha, beta, to delta and gamma. And it maps this physical leg to this physical leg. And it's defined by this 3 cocycle, by this expression. You can omit the details. You just have to keep in your mind that this is a 3 cocycle. Yes, so, oh yeah, you should also regard this as a virtual leg. That's, okay, yeah, I think the, yes. So here the local tensor, these are the virtual legs. These are the physical legs. But for these twisted quantum doubles and for the string nets, everything is actually at the beginning virtual leg, and then you just copy these links, these ijk, to physical legs. Yes, you can regard it in that way, or you can also regard this as a tensor with 6 virtual legs, and then you just put a GZ state at these ijk points and make them physical. So here, this is the pulling through for twisted quantum double. We have local tensor, which is a 3 cocycle. We have MPO, which is again a 3 cocycle. And we pull this MPO through the local tensor, and we get right-hand side. So why this is interesting? This is interesting because this is exactly a 3 cocycle equation. You can see that on left-hand side, I have 2 omega contracted in this special way. And at right-hand side, I have 3 omega, 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 contracted in this way. And if you do your bookkeeping correct, you will see that these indices contract in the correct way, such that this is a 3 cocycle equation, which is the object that classifies twisted quantum doubles in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay, so the string nets are also very similar to the twisted quantum doubles, but the main difference is that you don't have a 3 cocycle, but you have an F symbol. I put it G because this is kind of the symmetric version of F symbols. Wherever you see G, you can put F, doesn't matter. So string net states are, they define some ground states with some local properties where moving strings in the ground state is free, because that's nothing topological. That's topologically trivial. Again, you can annihilate or create trivial loops for free. This is again not topological, and you should have this in your ground state. So these are the two conditions that makes your state topological. But of course, if you only take into account these two conditions, you cannot, you will have infinitely many ground states. You will have infinitely many states that are that's possible. Like there are infinitely many states which satisfy these two rules. So you somehow have to fix, somehow your ground state should not scale with your system size. And that's why, that's essentially why you need some additional rule, which is given by this F symbol. So you have a string of I and M coming, fusing to N, splitting to L and J. Of course, there are different ways to do it. Another way to do it is in this way, M and L fuses to K and splits to I and J. And we say that this configuration in the ground state, if you write it, this configuration in the ground state, the coefficient of this configuration in the ground state is related to the coefficient of this configuration in the ground state by this G symbol. So if you know the coefficient of this ground state, you also know the coefficient of, if you know the coefficient of this configuration, you also know the coefficient of this configuration in your ground state. So starting from only one configuration, if you fix the coefficient of one trivial configuration in your ground state to one, you can obtain the coefficient of all other configurations, meaning that you can uniquely define your ground state on topologically trivial surfaces. Okay, there's this pentagon equation that has to be satisfied. And the reason that it has to be satisfied is that you don't want your state to be inconsistent. And what do I mean by that is that, so assume that you have this kind of configuration in your ground state, and it has some coefficient. So in the description of the ground state, and you want to find the weight of this configuration in the same ground state. There are two ways to obtain the weight of this from the weight of this. And the first way is in this way. Like you first apply this G symbol, you get this configuration, and then you get this configuration. And the other way to obtain the weight of this from this is in this way. It's like you have this 2G is equal to contraction of these 3G. And this is what people call pentagon equation, and it has to be satisfied for string net ground states, because otherwise you get different weights. So you start from the same weight and you get different weight for the same configuration, which is clearly an inconsistency in the ground state. Okay. So now we want to understand this in terms of the framework that I presented. So the tensor network state description of string nets has already been given in 2008. And you have this hexagonal lattice. You have virtual lines, virtual legs, and you have physical legs. These middle legs are physical legs, and these loops are virtual legs. And this local tensor is an F symbol modulo some details, some quantum dimensions. And we find that the matrix product operator that we can pull through this lattice should be of this form, where this is the kind of the physical leg, this middle leg, and this matrix product operator is labeled by this middle red leg. And if you look at pulling through for this special kind of states, this is the local tensor, this is the MPO, both of which are F symbols. And I pull MPO through the local tensor, and I obtain right hand side. And if you look at, again, when you do your bookkeeping correct, at left hand side you have two F symbols, at right hand side you have three F symbols with this specific contraction. This is nothing but the pentagon equation that I showed you two slides before. So we find out that these consistency conditions that twisted quantum doubles and stringnets have to satisfy are nothing but pulling through conditions. That's in our framework. Okay, so let me just quickly in two slides summarize the follow-up works. So we also found that these MPOs, like the framework that we presented, they are also useful to understand SPT phases, but there's some difference. Let me quickly summarize what these SPT states are. You have a global symmetry of the Hamiltonian, and your state also satisfies. Your state is also invariant under this global symmetry. Sorry, this should be tensor N. So the group acts on the state via some unitary representation, and it acts on the whole state at the same time with the same label, like UG tensor N. So if you respect this global symmetry, there's no way to smoothly and locally deform your ground state to a trivial state. But if you don't care about this global symmetry, then it's very easy to deform this SPT state to a trivial state. And that's why people call it symmetry protected topological state. So what we found in this work is that these are also characterized and also classified with the similar framework that we put for interesting topological order. But now the difference is that in the local tensor, when you act with this UG, you get an action on the virtual space, which is shown by this right-hand side. And then you again have similar properties, and you can show that these SPT states in 2 plus 1 dimensions, they are classified by three cocycles. And the very recent work, where we study anions, is that we try to understand somehow, given this framework, like if you don't think about string nets, if you don't think about fixed point models, how can we understand the excitations purely from these conditions that we put? And we came up with an excitation ansatz. And the idea behind this is that if we want some excitation, we have to go out of the ground state space. And these guys, like these, just remember the usual MPO loop operators, they define the ground state space. If you want to go out of this space, you have to deform it. And one simple guess is just to use these fusions of these MPOs to deform this local virtual subspace. So these are the MPO labels, these red labels. So the matrix product operator is continuum to the lattice in the usual way, but it ends up in this way, where the excitation sits on this vertex. So if there's an excitation on this vertex, it ends up like that. It's not continuing anywhere. It's just ending up like that.
Sorry, so far you've talked about vertices, tensors, MPO tensors, that
yes.
Have four
lengths. It can have 5, 6, 7.
But that has 3 lengths.
Yes, that's right.
So there's some definition that we then go through.
Yes, okay. That's correct. So these are the, please, go ahead.
And then where are physical images here?
Oh, here, they're only virtual legs.
Right.
And there's another leg, which will disappear a little bit, which will disappear in this. When we try to define the anions, this will disappear. But we have to take some sum over all these labels to find out the anions.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So somehow it looks like this A is an open index. Is this that's the point that's disturbing you? Yes. Which is fair, but this will disappear. This is not yet the object that described the anion. And that's actually how you exactly do it. So Okay, let me just continue a little bit more, just to this line, and then it will be clear. So if you look at these A's, you will find out that it constructs a finite dimensional C star algebra. And we know that we can block diagonalize this action A, and the orthogonal subspaces represent different anion sectors. And these are basically expressed in this form. So the anion sector I, the anion I, is described in this way, where we contracted this ABD index, so this A is too much here, with this tensor A, with this another, this is another MPO, this MPO A. So the defining property of these anion sectors is that they have to be orthogonal. So Pi times Pj should be delta ij Pi. And purely from this condition, you can find what these C's are. So you can construct your anion out of this A and from this condition.
Yes. Can I think of this anion being the endpoint of the C string going into this physical index in this vertex you showed?
So this A, it's actually contracted by this C.
Yes. But I mean, there's a string of this labeled by index C going into this.
Oh yeah, yeah. So this goes to the lattice,
okay,
to the bulk of the system, which will end with same type of thing at the other end of the anion.
Okay.
Yeah. So maybe just quickly summarize. So we saw that the quantum error correcting codes, they're somehow intrinsically connected to the phases of quantum matter, and I tried to motivate you that tensor network states are natural tools for studying ground states of physical systems. And then I presented axioms for topological orders in tensor network states. And these were MPO injectivity and pulling through for intrinsic and SPT phases. And then we finished with how to describe anions using MPO algebras. The future directions are, so one thing is, of course, it's kind of an obvious question. You did it in 2 plus 1, then what happens in 3 plus 1 or 4 plus 1 and so on? And what we did, which is an unpublished work, is that instead of matrix product operators, which are one-dimensional, we have tensor network operators or tensor product operators, which looks like surface operators, which are like two-dimensional, three-dimensional, or higher, depending on in which spacetime you're working on. And you still have similar kind of conditions. So this surface operator, you still should be pulled through your lattice. And there are some kind of extended excitations over higher dimensional manifolds, which are like the boundaries of these tensor network operators. And the other future direction is to study, again, in 2 plus 1D and then in higher dimensions, that what if we have local fermionic degrees of freedom? It should again be that like fermionic MPOs, we should have fermionic MPOs that we can pull through. But then the natural question is what are the excitations? What are the emergence statistics? Are they really different from those that we find with only spins? And so on. And of course, the grand question is to study topological phase transitions using these framework and some other insights. So I just take only a little while to thank my collaborators. The work that I showed you here are mainly in collaboration with guys in Vienna, Ghent, and Aachen. Stuff about higher dimensions are a collaboration with Michael Walter and Christian Temme. Thanks a lot for your time, for listening to me. I will appreciate the questions.